Ladies and gentlemen, be upstanding for Laura Tingle. And Laura, here comes that Dorothy Dixer. What's a mere 60 billion between friends?
Oh, I don't know. You can be such a hard man, Philip. I mean, it's just a little incy-wincy error. But $60 billion is a spectacularly large error, Philip, as is a miscalculation of 3 million unemployed. I suppose my feeling about this is it's obviously politically embarrassing, and it's embarrassing for the Treasury. In the defence of the people who made the estimate, they were making it the week when the world was apparently ending and people were announcing new restrictions on the economy every day and nobody really knew what was going to happen. But I suppose there are two things that come out of this. One of them is at least it didn't actually involve the spending of money for bad purposes. In fact, no money has been spent in the production of this estimate. But I think the other thing about all this, Philip, is I was thinking about this today as I was driving along. We've been talking for weeks and weeks and weeks about how the government's been tweaking its policy on the health side of the coronavirus. It keeps changing. It and the states keep changing their policies for the conditions on in terms of social lockdowns and restrictions and all that sort of stuff. I think what this really comes down to is that it hasn't really done the same thing on economic policy. It came out and announced JobKeeper, which everybody said at the time, look, the intention of this is good. The general idea is good. It's probably pretty hairy around the edges and we'll find that out. So considering they did find it out and it hasn't actually cost us anything extra as such, that's good. But as we've discussed on a number of occasions over the last few weeks, there are obviously huge glaring gaps in the JobKeeper policy as they affect arts in particular, the hospitality sector, international students, and the sort of fairly shameful sight of international students queuing for food because they've just basically been left completely in the lurch, as well as other temporary migrant holders. So while the government's been quite good at continuing to adjust the health side of its response to the coronavirus, it hasn't been prepared to do that on economic policy. And it's now at this point of saying, oh, well, it's not as many people went on to this wage subsidy as we thought, so that's good because it means it won't end up costing us as much money.
Laura, my grasp of mathematics is as limited as my grasp of theology. However, and I find it very hard to calculate 10% for a tip, but it seems to me that amount of money, this hypothetical 60, 70 billion, means that a little bit extra might be available thither and yon. You mentioned a couple of contenders, but there must be many groups with their hands up.
Well, absolutely. And it really, I think, the sort of damaging the impact of the embarrassment, if you like, Philip, is not so much that somebody made a terribly spectacular mathematical error. It's the fact that, you know, they kept saying we don't have enough money to, you know, there's a line in the sand, Philip, thus far and no further. Well, if you're only spending half as much as you thought, but you thought it was worth spending twice as much, that suggests it's probably a good idea to still spend twice as much, but spend it in a different way. And I think, and that's not just because you're trying to be nice to people, but it's because you need to get the economy going again, which is what the Prime Minister says he wants to do. And sectors like the arts contribute about $111 billion a year to the economy. And if they're not working and the people in them aren't working, that's obviously not very good for the economy. Now, we've got this sort of second round of arguments today about this, which is people pointing out if the amount being spent isn't anywhere near as great as it would be, the stimulus isn't as great, and therefore the economy's not going to bounce back or snap back or whatever it is the Prime Minister's saying. But it does also suggest that if not all that many people have registered for JobKeeper, it creates all sorts of new questions about whether the economic downturn is as bad or whether, in fact, there's just a lot more people than we realise who aren't in a position to claim it, which I think is the crucial thing here. It's not, you know, it's the JobKeeper is not necessarily a good proxy for the state of the economy.
Because of the drought, Laura, I think I told you off air, I haven't planted a barley crop, so I'm not immediately in jeopardy over the trade tiff with China. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is it continues to go backward and forward with argy-bargy, Philip, with sort of various new areas of trade potentially under threat. But we've got this new sort of flank that opened over the weekend, which goes to a conservative attack on, or renewed attack on Daniel Andrews and the Victorian government for signing up to the Belt and Road Initiative, the Chinese sort of
infrastructure. I didn't realise the Victorian Premier was effectively a traitor.
Well, calling him a traitor is colourful. I suppose there are two things here. One of them is that there are really big questions about the Belt and Road Initiative and what it's done around the world. The fact that it's left a lot of quite, you know, it's built often, dare one say, quite shoddy infrastructure in places that couldn't otherwise afford it, but have actually found out that they are actually paying for it, not the Chinese after all, and it's created all sorts of debt and obligation problems. So there are really significant issues with the Belt and Road Initiative, so it's not entirely clear why Daniel Andrews might have signed up to it. But we had this rather extraordinary spectre opening on the weekend where Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, was interviewed on a rather unique television program on Sky called Offsiders, and in the process of which basically suggested that the United States might sort of cut Australia adrift as a result of the Daniel Andrews move, which in turn led to this rather extraordinary intervention by the US ambassador to Australia, Ambassador Culverhouse, who came out to basically do one of those, what the Secretary of State meant to say was press releases, and was sort of saying that, you know, in fact, that wasn't exactly what the United States were going to do. So the interesting bit about that, I suppose, is it once again shows the dangers of all of this for Australia, which is that while it's fair enough for us to speak out about issues, whether it's to say, well, you know, we should have an inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus, or whether it's we should want to speak up about a particular issue that directly affects us involving China, we find ourselves in this much bigger game at the moment between China and the US, where both sides are escalating their rhetoric. And I think in some ways that's a bit more dangerous in the current state of this brawl than the actual escalation of things about barley and other trade.
I'll be
from
taking
Australia.
This up with Michael Bartos in the next story, who sees the conflict, the ongoing and growing conflict between the US and China, as immensely dangerous for all sorts of other reasons, which will become clear, dear listener, as you stick around on Late Night Live, where I'm currently talking to Laura Tingle. Energy. Been a bit of hubbub on this front. What's been your assessment of this splendid technology investment roadmap?
Philip, it's so depressing. we had a lot of talk about...
Share your woes with us, Laura. Think of the program as therapy.
Angus Taylor of Downloaded Documents fame, who's also the energy minister, put out the energy roadmap last week. And, I think in some ways the less said about it, the better, because it sort of looked like every other energy roadmap the government's put out, you know, talked, but sort of caught up, you know, have we mentioned nuclear power again? Have we mentioned carbon capture and storage and other random wild ideas? But putting a very big focus on gas as the sort of transition fuel to what they now sort of very quietly and in very small letters concede is a renewable energy future. Now, I think the only interesting thing was the de-emphasising, if you like, of discussion of coal, which of course is what various members of the National Party would like to see as the transition power. But while there's talk about maximising the efficiency or some such term of existing power stations, there's no beating the drums about the great cause of coal in the paper, which I think is a small sign of movement in a fairly depressing spectre of policy from this particular government.
I'm palpitating with excitement because tomorrow the Prime Minister is giving an address, which I trust will be virtual, to the National Press Club. What do you expect he'll cover? And I know you know already because, you know, they always leak these things to you.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of talk about the path out. I think there will be a bit of an attempt to reinforce the philosophical point about how you can't get out of a hole by spending more money. There will be a lot of talk about skills and industrial relations. Now, the government keeps insisting it does not want to take a confrontational approach on industrial relations, that it wants to leave it to the employers and the unions to sort of work out what needs to be done, because everybody does agree that something needs to be done on IR just to make it more functional. So there'll be a bit of talk about that, and there'll be a lot about skills. And once again, it feels like I'm hearing the skills reset about how clunky the skills and training sector is for about the 45th time in my career. And I really hope that this one's more successful than all the other ones.
We do indeed hope that, and thank you, Laura. Great to talk to you.